Accession number 27091, Mr. Ken Bean, reel number 2. Now, we were talking about your first job when you left school, finally, at the Clark's College in January 1941. Now, how did you get this job for Unilever, and what was it as? What was that?
That's a question I can't precisely answer how I got it. I honestly don't remember. I've often thought, since I've lived in the Midlands, which is the past 30-odd years, I've noticed the difference between people having grammar school education or that type of education in the South and those in the Midlands, that whereas here people, young chaps, tend to gravitate into industry, in the Southeast the gravitation was towards large companies, banks, building societies, insurance companies, with a work of an administration nature. Now, Unilever was one of the large employers which attracted school leavers. They required London University matric. I may have applied to them. I probably did, but in any event, I was taken on. Everybody who joined Unilever joined as a messenger. Once again, the messenger activity comes up. And there I was a messenger for a period of about a month, which I enjoyed very much, actually.
What did it entail? Where were you based?
Based at Unilever House at Blackfriars, where I used to go up every day on the tram from New Cross. And the boys, who were all of my age, obviously had an assembly point somewhere in the basement, I seem to remember. And we were, during the day, allocated different jobs to take packages, normally letters, to different depots or, I suppose, customers of Unilever, buyers, companies purchasing from Unilever in different parts of London. I can remember, for example, going out on the Piccadilly line to Cockfosters, which is a place I'd never heard of before, taking a message. And that lasted for about a month or perhaps.
Did you see much of the effect of bombing then? Because you're travelling about on the tubes and the rest of it. Would you not see the... Was your travelling interrupted much by the effects of the bombing?
Well, I can't say I can remember in central London, although it obviously had been bombed. The east end of London certainly was the early targets for the German Air Force. There were signs of bombing, yes, but I don't know that the travel was much, not normally affected. I didn't go to Blackfriars. I didn't stay there actually very long because after about a month, they posted me to a department in Oxford Street, somewhere at the back of Selfridges. And I have to say, I didn't enjoy this very much at all. Didn't sort of get on with the man who was in charge, and one of those things I suppose you do sometimes, maybe don't get the right advice or you make the wrong decision. I decided to leave Unilever.
Now you're working as a messenger there as well?
No, I was working, the messenger function had ceased. I was working as a bit of a dog's body, I suppose, in one of the departments, and didn't enjoy that very much. And I left after. I gave my notice to Unilever's. Whether it was wise or not, who can say, but it leads you down different passages. But after I left Lever Brothers, or Unilever, I can't remember how I came to get this job, but I joined the Inland Revenue locally in Catford. And I moved around. I was a temporary clerk because the civil service did not employ people during the war years on a permanent basis. You became a temporary clerk doing whatever work was appropriate. And I think I worked for the revenue in three locations. One was in Catford and then in Kennington, again in southeast London, and finally in Oxford Street in the West End of London, and I used to travel up there from Brockley in those days. The trains were very reliable. I used to go to London Bridge and get a bus from there to Oxford Street. And again, there were, I suppose, signs of there were obviously signs of bombing, but I can't really remember the trains actually being disrupted by air now, reaction.
What were you actually doing as a temporary clerk? What was your job? What was your work?
Clerical work on, I suppose, obviously the simpler of clerical tasks associated with tax returns and so on. But the work that would be done now, for example, if you went into a tax office today, was done by what they called tax officers who were permanent employees of the revenue. And I think they had a senior tax officer who was a man of greater years. But they were people, of course, who'd been in the civil service from pre-war days. And as I recall, they were, I don't think we called them exempt. They were, well, they were exempt from military service or being called up. They were in a reserved occupation. That's the expression I wanted. Reserved occupation. So none of those people really ever left the revenue, as far as I'm aware. And I think even those that might have wanted to go in the services and volunteered did so with difficulty. But I worked there for about, so we're going from what, 1941 through 42. I suppose I worked for the revenue for about a year and a half, because by the time I'd left Lever Brothers and then got this other job, it was taking us up to the end of 1942. But and we're coming up really to the point, the time when I went in the Navy.
Now, were you aware, what were you planning to do? Were you planning to volunteer, or were you just prepared to wait till you were called up, which is what most people did? Or what were your plans? Why the Navy? You know, all this sort of question.
Yes, well, fairly simple to answer. I mean, my father had been in the Navy in the First World War. And I'm never quite sure now, unfortunately it's too late to find out how long he'd been in the Navy. I know the ship he served on. He was on motor torpedo boats, and it was a sort of, sounds a bit exaggerated, but in a sense a naval tradition that I grew up with. I mean, for example, one thing I still remember, that young people, you know, didn't always get out of bed, weren't too keen to getting out of bed early in the morning. And my father would always call out, "Lash up and stow," which was, of course, a naval expression still in vogue in the 1940s, which meant that people had to get out of their hammocks, lash them up and stow them away. And that was an expression he used to use. So, but not only that, my father's mother came from, I suppose, fishing, seagoing people in Scotland. His mother came from Rothsay in the Isles of Bute, and he'd always had a leaning towards the sea. Whenever we went on holiday, wherever we went, invariably there was a sea trip involved, on a paddle steamer, something of that kind. So although I, in one sense you might say I wasn't taken to the sea, because I didn't learn to swim until quite late in life, it was never a question with me as to what service I went in. And of course, if you waited until you were called up, you didn't always get in the service of your choice. So what I did was to volunteer just before my 18th birthday would have been, what, in 1942. So I was due to be called up in November of 1942. I think I volunteered probably just before that time, maybe a month before that time, because there was a scheme open to young men who wanted to go in the Navy, known as the Y Scheme. And this was a scheme, again, open to people. I think you were required to have education at least up to matriculation standard. And what happened was that you made an application, and then eventually you were called for interview somewhere in the area of Admiralty Arch, pell mell, I think it probably was. You were called for an interview before a board, and this was probably, I'm never really quite sure now whether this actually happened or whether it was something that people talked about, but it was the sort of interview where you were asked a number of questions, why you wanted to join the Navy, what your background was and so on, and then you'd probably get some sort of silly question about a ship sailing along at 20 knots and the breeze blowing the other way at 20 knots, which way was the smoke going? I think that might have figured, but I'm not entirely sure. But anyway, I went for the interview and I was accepted. So from that time, I suppose, I was officially in the Navy from about February of 1943. They didn't call me up until, I think, right at the beginning of April.
So you volunteered in October 42?
Yes.
But that you then just carried on working for the Inland
Army? I carried on working until I was called up, yes.
Now, what was the call-up procedure?
Papers through the post with instructions to report to HMS Collingwood, which was a land-based establishment, which still exists today, I might say, in Fareham in Hampshire. You were sent travel instructions and railway warrants.
And this was April?
This would have come to me, I suppose, sometime in March. I can't remember the exact date I joined up, but it was right at the beginning of April.
And so you set off there. Now, what was your reception when you got to HMS Collingwood? Because, you know, you arrive as a civilian and you'd not had any much trouble with the military.
Right. None at all. Well, not really, apart from going back to the holidays. Invariably it involved going to things like Navy Days, if we were any. So I'd been on naval vessels before. The reception was, what was it like? The train left Waterloo Station and arrived in Portsmouth. In those days, there was a steam train that took you to Fareham. And by this time, again, memory's a little bit vague on individuals, but obviously there were other lads there who were on the same train, and we all arrived together at Fareham Station, which in those days, I'm going back now 60 years, was a very small sort of country place, a country town. Very different today, I think. There's been much development in that area. But there would have been a naval truck of some kind to transport us to Collingwood, which was about, as I remember, about 2 miles from the station. I remember it because on nighttime leave, you had to walk the 2 miles and the 2 miles back. Reception, I don't know. It was,
you know, when you go through the gates, you cease to be a civilian, don't you?
Absolutely, yes, yes. There would have been a kitting out procedure. I can still remember the way Collingwood was organised. The Navy may be very different today, I'm sure it is, but I don't call it a barracks because the only reference in the Navy to barracks were the three main divisions. It was a shore-based establishment and it was divided into parts of ship. So you had foretop, you had quarterdeck, you had forecastle and so on. And I think there were four divisions. And the design of this camp must have been symmetrical in the sense that there were probably four segments, each of them identical. And there was a central parade ground and there was a master-at-arms office at the gate. But yes, going into the gate, I can't remember much about how I felt now about it. But you were allocated to a hut and along with 30 or so other lads. And
would that happen before or after you were kitted out?
Well, initially you went to the hut and then you were kitted out. That was kitting out.
We'll do the hut. So we'll do the kitting out. What were you kitted out with? Is it you were
ordinary seaman.
So what were you kitted out with?
That's a good question. How many suits? The Navy. I seem to recall that certainly in the peacetime navy, sailors had about five different suits. I don't think we were issued out with that sort of number, but I think there were two suits issued, one a best and one a working suit, but I can't really remember much more about that. The Matlow's uniform was the bell-bottom trousers, the blouse, and a front, which consisted of a piece of cloth that went over the head and had a blue line across the top, so that that was the only part that showed in the V of the blouse, and hat, of course, with and we all looked rather new in those days. But that's about all I can remember of what kit was issued.
Now what
and
about
boots, of course, boots and fairly thick socks.
And what was your hut like?
They were Nissen huts, really. They were, when I say Nissen, perhaps that's not quite correct. They were built of wood. They had room to accommodate, I suppose, about 20 beds either side. I think they must have been in two tiers, although again I can't be sure about that. But what I do remember, and it just comes back to me as we speak, they all had in the middle a stove, a wood-burning stove, with a chimney that went up through the roof. And there were steps up to the hut. They were very much like the sort of huts you see in old films about prisoner of war camps, and I don't mean to draw any undue comparison, but that's basically what they were like. And there were a number of these huts side by side. That's about as much as I can remember of the huts.
Now, if we look at a typical day's training, it allows us to wander about the subject and pick up things at will. What I know, there's no such thing as a typical day. What time would the day start? What would you do first thing in the morning?
Well, it would have started relatively early. Whether the wake-up call came at 7, it certainly didn't come after 7. I suppose we must have gone to breakfast. I don't think there was PT beforehand.
Well, let's talk about the food generally, since we raised it.
Yeah.
What was the food like overall for you, coming from a reasonably well-off background? How did you react to the Navy food at Collingwood?
To be honest, I don't really remember much about the quality of the food. I do remember more about the quality of food in shipboard life later on, but I can't remember. It was served certainly rather like school dinner style, with in a separate hut, which I don't really remember what name it went under. I suppose whether it was a canteen, but each mess, as it were, each hut had its own table, so that it was, again, rather like forms at school. The food was certainly not conspicuous in by its quality. It was very ordinary sort of food. And
Was there enough of it?
I was never hungry, no. I was never hungry.
Well, that's not now. So after your breakfast, I presume you'd have various training sessions. You mentioned PT. What physical state were you in, and how did the PT sessions, did they build you up, or was it, you know, did they push you?
Well, of course, entrance into the forces in those days, I didn't mention, but it did involve obviously a medical examination, and the requirement was to be A1, whatever that meant. I was reasonably fit, I suppose. I wasn't unduly pressed by any of the physical training. It involved a number of things apart from the conventional PT that you might associate with schools, where people were doing press-ups and things of this kind. There were gymnasiums, obviously. But one of the exercises we had to do was to climb up a rigging. Now, I should explain that in the centre of the parade ground, there was artificial construction of a rigging. It didn't look like a ship's rigging, but that was what the intention was. It was about, I don't know, I suppose about maybe 30 yards in length, and it was shaped like you might say a row of beans with structure going that way and coming down straight the other side.
So diagonally up.
That's right, yes. And what you had to do, the part of this exercise, was climb up the straight part, go over the top and come down the other side. And there was a time, I think, when that had to be done in gas masks. I can't remember too much about that now.
Didn't have masthead drill, though. There wasn't a masthead like there was at Ganges.
No, there wasn't. Well, if there was, there was no drill. But, of course, part of the occupation of a normal day, which I'd really forgotten until speaking about it now, is that we had classes, and the classes were in seamanship.
Well, tell me about that. What could you learn in classes?
We don't call them knots, or they did call them knots, but bins and hitches is the expression used in the Navy, which was a little bit of that. And my memory is, perhaps I wasn't concentrating at the time, but not too distinct on how much time was spent on this, or indeed how much time, I suppose, was on other aspects in class. But there must have been some, because we were not doing, we were not square bashing, as they used to call it, all the time. There was a certain amount of that.
I'll come back to drill. What else other than knots and hitches?
There must have been seamanship involving the rules of the road, that sort of thing. I find difficulty in remembering much about what was taught. It was a general, I suppose, seamanship course. It would have lasted, I suppose, and now what was it, about 6 weeks, I think, at Fareham. But my memory is a bit patchy on that, I'm afraid, on what was actually done.
What about drill? How did you take to drill, you know?
Well, reasonably well. It was a bit tedious, I suppose. There were occasions, of course, when we did other things like...
Did you see the point in drill at the time, as opposed to perhaps now?
Not really, no. I don't know that we ever thought much about it. It was just something you had to do and was accepted. People just took it as, you know, that was what was going to be done, and it didn't have too much bearing on naval matters. I think a lot of people felt that.
Was there any other training you used? Seamanship, drill, PT, anything else you were doing?
It was
any
PT.
Any weapons training?
Not at that time, no, not at that time.
No gunnery or anything like that?
Not at that time, no. This was never intended by the induction course, I think. It was merely this sort of thing would be dealt with later on if one went into gunnery, if one went to signalling or anything of that kind. There would be courses would be devoted to it.
Now, how did you get on with your fellow recruits?
Well, I really can't remember anything about... I can't remember the people, really, that I was with then. Later on, yes, I can. I made some very good friendships in the Navy. But my recollections of that first period are very vague in terms of people.
Well, I mean, was there any trouble between them? You know, because they must have come from a variety of backgrounds.
They did. There was no trouble at all that I remember. I don't recall any falling out with people at all.
It's just you didn't make personal friends with them.
Didn't. In a way, I suppose it wasn't long enough. The course lasted, I think it was about, it might have been 6 or 10 weeks. Obviously, I had friends and buddies because there was, as we called it, shore leave, which involved walking down to the village of Fareham, where the Navy weren't too popular, and usually having a couple of pints of beer, which wasn't too palatable, lukewarm beer in the local pubs.
Now, you say that the Navy wasn't too popular in Fareham. How did that show itself?
It was said that people wouldn't, that the local population didn't. I mean, there was no open hostility, but it was said that the people weren't too keen on having the Navy there, and the same was true in Portsmouth, but I don't know, that's maybe just hearsay.
Now, what about the instructors? What were they like? How did you get on with them? I mean, what was their attitude to you?
Again, I can't really remember who the instructors were. I honestly don't remember.
How did they treat you, though?
Well, they treated us well enough. I don't think there was any... There was certainly no personal abuse. I mean, you see a lot of watching a film the other night of... American film of people joining the American Marines, where the first half of it seemed to consist solely of personal abuse. There was nothing like that at all. Yes, in there were, obviously there was fairly caustic language used in if marching wasn't carried out properly, or if anything wasn't if anything wasn't done properly. But there was no abuse. Some of them were, I suppose, were a bit fatherly, I suppose, in terms of young chaps who'd just joined up, particularly if they were old-time sailors. And some of them were. Some of the instructors had served in the Navy during the First World War and had been brought back into the reserve, from the reserve, to do this sort of job of training people. But I don't have any clear recollections about people in Collingwood. I do have later times, because I went back to Collingwood later in my service, when I can remember particular characters who were master at arms or...
We'll come back to that, yeah. So how were you being assessed? Was it any... This WISE scheme, did that give you a special status? I mean, were you seen as a potential officer? Or what was
yes,
that?
I was. And I, in fact, I didn't really, I suppose, in their terms... make the grade at that stage for a commission. It turned on, I suppose, what was regarded as leadership qualities, which perhaps I lacked in that time. At 18, I had maybe again sort of training into that would have been had I stayed at the grammar school to become a prefect and so on. But I didn't make the grade into that, so. At the end of the day, I did go to, I think they called it a psychology unit. It was really a unit they had in Collingwood where people were assessed as to what they wanted to do, whether they wanted to go into the Stoker branch, which I certainly didn't, the Signalman branch, anything of this kind. And I... really asked to go on to become a radar and a radio mechanic, which you might say was a bit at odds with some of my earlier comments on my school activity when science wasn't one of my top subjects. But I was interested in radio and radar from a particular friend I'd got at the time before I went in the Navy. And that's what I asked to do.